Mindful music covers sensitive topics, which may include suicide. So if you're in need of help, in the U.S., call 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And in Canada, call Talk Suicide Canada at 1-833-456-4566. This program is for entertainment purposes and is not meant to be a substitute for medical advice. Good day, I'm Kyle Shallowhorn, and on today's episode of Mindful Music, I'm joined by our guest, David Quartet, Toronto-based prog rock musical string ensemble. This is coming up right after this news. Welcome back to Mindful Music. My guests are David Quartet, who reign from Toronto. David Quartet is comprised of Liza McClellan, cello and electric cello. She's also the group's primary writer and arranger and vocalist. Tamley Howe, violin, electric violin and vocals. Sharon Lee, violin, viola, electric five-string violin and viola and vocals. Moira Burke, viola, violin, electric five-string violin and viola and vocals. And finally, Mackenzie Longpre, drums. Deva recently released their third studio album, Prometheus, in 2022, just in the heels of their second album, 2112, which was released in 2020 and features a full-length instrumental tribute to Canadian icon Rush's suite of the same name. Prometheus has been featured in various prog rock journals and music podcasts. Deva was honored to have their rendition of 2112 distributed on disc and given a special feature by the UK magazine Prague in 2020. Deva's groundbreaking tribute to Rush's 2112 led to being invited to perform at the 2022 Memorial for late Neil Peart, A Night for Neil, held at the Meridian Center in St. Catharines, which I had the privilege to attend. A multi-genre string quartet, Dave has held residencies at the University of Toronto's New Music Festival and San Jacinto College in Texas, where they perform works on both acoustic and electric instruments, as well as provided master classes and composer workshops with both sets of instruments. Dave's other notable live performances include the 2022 Canada Games, Canada Day at Yonge and Dundas Square in 2018 and 2014, and the countdown launch for the Pan Am Games. When in electric mode, David performs high-energy sets with effects pedals and wireless cables, enabling them to encourage interaction with the audience through movement. David became a Yamaha Canada Artist in 2011 and a Dario Canada Artist in 2013. Liza and Moira, thank you so much for joining us today. Unfortunately, your bandmates, Emily, Mackenzie, and Sharon, aren't able to join us, but I'm really just so glad to have you both here with us.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
So I just want to start by saying that I was so blown away by seeing you perform 2112. As a huge Rush fan myself, I want to say thank you for that. I was so impressed that you pulled off that piece in a way that was unique, that I'd never heard Grund quite that way before. So I just want to start off with you, Liza, asking, of course, you arranged that piece, and also for your album Prometheus, you co-produced it, wrote it, and arranged the music. You got your start, though, with the Canadian ensemble Quartetto Gelato. How did that all come together, those things?
Oh, I don't know. it's sometimes you just go with the flow, and some opportunities land in your lap, and you say, okay, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try my best. I'm going to learn about this. I went to school for music, and if anybody ever asked me, is your goal to write a few albums worth of music or arrange Rush's 2112 for string quartet, I would have said no. I'm just in school learning to play the cello. That's what I'm going to do. And then things happen, things change. Quartetto Gelato gave me a great opportunity. I did lots of touring and performing, and some of those things, those skills that I learned through that group, I've had the opportunity to, you know, provide to this my own group, co-founded for Deva Quartet.
So really, when you think about it, your background in classical music is really the basis for what you do, but this, of course, is with a twist. So how do you take a classical background and transform it into something like you do with Deva and say a piece like 2112?
I guess, you know what? I feel like prog rock is the next step from classical in many ways, because it is very complex and generally lots of layers and things going on. The same way you would have like a Shostakovich symphony or a Beethoven symphony. There's lots of things going on, lots of dynamic structure and melodies and harmonies. And it's not that simple, you know, not generic, but the standard rock lines that we get in most popular music these days. So for me, I guess it was lucky in the sense that I have that classical background. I've learned to, it's like another language that you learn. And those skills, I think, translated naturally into prog music. I mean, to be honest, though, I grew up in a, my parents are very musical. My dad's a bass player. And we had classical music playing all the time, but he also was a big Yes fan, Rush fan, prog musicians, Peter Gabriel, but also Led Zeppelin and The Police, and like you name the Beach Boys, the Beatles, like all these bands. So I grew up very much immersed in all music, pretty much. And I think that's really influenced where I've gone with my own career.
That's wonderful. I want to ask specifically, of course, on the Suite from Prometheus, the album that is really interesting. The take, it does take this idea of a suite. It's a whole story you're telling. And on that particular suite, Maid of Orleans, which I really enjoy, it's written as the perspective of Joan of Arc, of course, Maid of Orleans. And there's lyrics saying, I'm just a girl, I'm just like you, I had to do what I had to do. And I'm thinking of young women in the contemporary age. And I think it's sort of like, am I understanding correctly, when you wrote those lyrics, in a way you were almost contemporizing it, if that's the way to put it, make it contemporary where it relates to young women today?
Yeah, I think that's what we were hoping to do, to sort of humanize her a bit more. That seems to be where the focus is these days, and discovering that it's this person wasn't just a story, but it was an actual person. And their narrative these days is really turning towards, you know, powerful women or women that have gone through some crazy stuff in their life and have, you know, either risen above it or have just like, this is what happened, and have inspired other people. I didn't write those lyrics. Those were written by Sam McCollum, my sister.
Oh.
Yeah. But she's a wonderful lyricist, and she was great to collaborate with. And I can speak on her behalf in saying that that was very much forefront in trying to bring a modern understanding of what Joan of Arc kind of went through as a female in the Middle Ages, when women really didn't have a voice at all. And through her, as she was, what's the word? Through her research, she discovered that a lot of women were actually accused of speaking to God. It was actually a fairly commonplace thing, and it became an excuse to people were using these other people to put forward political ideas or pursuits. And Joan of Arc's story is maybe she may not even have been one person. You know, she right. could have been, this might be the combined stories of a few women that went through it. We don't really know. But it was kind of interesting for her to dig into that and learn about the crazy things going on at that time.
That's so fascinating when you think about it, how certainly other groups, I think an Orchestra Moon, who was in the dark, right? They have, you know, Maid of Orleans certainly as well. I wanted to get to what we also do in our program, which is talk about music and how it relates to your most well-being. And I know you have a song that you want to share. I ask guests to bring a song, which of course people say, how could I think of a song of all of those songs? But you have one in particular you want to talk about.
When you ask for a song that to do with well-being, you could go down a couple different avenues. And one avenue, I went to kind of a dark place, and like, when I'm sad, I listen to this. But I thought, let's not go down that avenue. I want to talk about something that I put on that's uplifting. I love this song. It's a song that I grew up hearing as a kid. I was obsessed with the movie Labyrinth. And I'm a huge David Bowie fan. I think he's an incredible artist. And for me, I think it's just, it's one of those things, humans hear certain sounds, especially from childhood, and it brings you back to a happy place if you have had a happy childhood. And this is a song I put on if I need that extra burst of energy or just something to get me through. I'll put it on when I'm cleaning the house. I'll put it on if I am feeling a bit low sometimes. I'll put it on to celebrate. You know, it's that kind of song for me.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes in that respect, this music that you're talking about is the kind of thing that helps us to ground ourselves. It almost serves as a frame of reference. Would you say that? Because it's been sort of like a recurring theme.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's music is so important to people, whether we're aware of it or not. It is the soundtrack to our lives, and it can take you back to places. Just sound can bring you back the same way that a smell from your childhood can bring you back, you know? And sometimes you can't even put your finger on what it is that you're feeling, but I think it's so important to have that. If we didn't have that outlet, I can't even imagine the world. It would be tragic.
We're back with Mindful Music. I'm here with Liza McClellan and Moira Burke from David Quartet. We just heard David Bowie with Underground from the soundtrack of the 1986 movie Labyrinth. And in the film, Bowie stars as the character Jareth, the Goblin King. So, Moira, I know that you've been Yamaha Canada artist since 2011 and D'Addario Canada artist since 2013. But how did you all first get together as a band?
Oh, wow. So we got together, I think, through just mutual connections. I actually went to National Youth Orchestra with Liza back in 2003. It was a while ago, and with that orchestra we toured Japan and China and the Western Canada. But we didn't actually reconnect until we had both moved back to Toronto. I don't think either of us were living in Toronto at the time, and I was just playing in an orchestra, and so was she. So that's how we kind of reconnected. And we had one of our former violinists that was also playing there. And she knew Emily, and so the four of us got together. And when our former violinist, Phoebe, when she left our quartet, we brought in Sharon. And that was kind of the beginning to this amazing quartet that we have now, because we have changed a lot since Sharon came on board. And within a year of having Sharon on board, we were sponsored by Yamaha. So a lot has happened. A lot happened very quickly when we kind of changed the direction of our quartet and had Sharon come along.
Yeah, and I have to say, Sharon, who is not here, I at the Night from Yale, which I said I was so fortunate to be at, I was front row. And I was actually on Sharon's side of the stage. And I had to say, she wouldn't stop moving. I mean, just all over the place. And all of you were, but I was like, wow, they're really amazing. So that's really what kind of drew me to you as a group, but also how you play together. First of all, it is a very complex piece. I would encourage all of the listeners to go on to YouTube, and there's different variations. I mean, there's a studio variation that she can see of you playing this, but it's a complex piece. If anyone's familiar with 2112, but to do it in an arrangement that is a string ensemble and with all of even the movement and everything that you do, it is a demonstration of how you embody the music, right? Would you say that you embody it? Because it isn't just playing; you're moving, you're feeling it. How would you describe that?
I absolutely agree. I think we all feel the music. And the way our group, I think, has worked from the get-go when Sharon came along is that we just have this energy together that clicks. And I think, you know, we all feel music in different ways, but collectively when we come together, it just works. I don't know how else to say it. We do move in sync with each other, and we have developed a lot of little, you know, cues and eye contact for sure, and things that help us go. But I'm glad that you loved that performance. Sharon is extremely interactive, and she definitely feels every note that she plays, and we feed off each other. You know, the energy has to be there, and that's what makes us.
So speaking of the concert again, I just have to go back to this because as a witness to this event, you're there in front of, 5,000 roughly Rush fans, and then they're just regular Rush fans. These are literally Rush fans who came from all over the world. Now, mind you, I'm from Buffalo, but I know there are people all over the States. It was a pilgrimage. I mean, even at the point of going to Lakeside Park, which is the place where, you know, the song which Neil wrote, you've got a lot of devotees in the audience. What feel like, I'm going to this both of you, what did it feel like to play in front of a devoted audience, knowing that, okay, here are a bunch of people who are really pretty critical about what they listen to? What was that like?
First, I think this goes hand in hand with the kind of music that we're playing. So Rush fans, they are prog music fans. Rush music is very, there's so much going on. And there's, when you're asked to do something so important, a concert in memorial of one of the world's most wonderful drummers, one of the best drummers of all time, and you have to go play a 21-minute long piece in front of an audience that knows every single note, and not just note, like they can air drum it. They know all.
I was one of those people in the front audience. You saw me. That was me. Every note.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's incredibly, it was an honor to do it. It was incredibly humbling to do it, to walk out on stage and look out. There's so many people. They're like, how many people? 5,000? Something like that. Gosh, it was, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. And I'll never forget, because people didn't know what we were initially. We kind of, like most people didn't know. We're, you know, we are what we are. We walk out and we're plugging in our little violins and things. We're like, what is that? Who are these people? As within like the first three notes, people knew what we were playing and they got it. And as we progressed through the performance, the energy of the crowd that came up with us was incredible. It was one of the most, and I've been performing all my life, like since I was a teenager. This was one of the best experiences I've ever had. So truly.
And the way, I remember the ovation was just,
amazing.
You must have been overwhelmed.
We were like, wow. There's no,
I can
say actually, I did. There were no words, because what we do is a bit strange, you know? You never know how something will be accepted or not, especially in that situation where it is very precious. And the 2112 suite to many Rush fans is kind of, it's in the canon, you know? You don't mess with it. And we were so careful. We were very precious with it. Everything had to be exactly as close as we could get.
Yeah, I mean, Eliza said it best. It's one of the most precious performances that I've ever performed, for sure. I think there was a fear getting on that stage that, you know, the audience wouldn't take to us because we are so different and, you know, we don't have guitars or, you know, things in our hands. And so there was definitely that fear. But as the show progressed, there was, this amazing energy that just kind of came to the stage. And I think that really led our performance as well, you know. I'll remember it forever. It's definitely a career highlight for me.
So I know the phrase soundtrack of our lives was mentioned. I think you mentioned Eliza. So Maura, when you think about your life with music, when did you start playing? And of course, I know you started very young, and you started probably, as I'm believing, more of a classical, at least training. What has it been like to live a life of a musician? I'm not a musician. I learned how to sing when I was younger. I'm not a musician per se. I'm truly a music lover. What does it mean to be, like, how does it feel, live, work, eat, breathe music?
Whoa, that's such a big question.
Loaded.
Yeah, it's loaded. So I started violin when I was five. My grandparents took me to see a concert, and I came home and I was like, I'm going to play the violin. And that was the beginning to my career, I guess. I never really questioned my own career. I knew in high school I wanted to go to university in music. Did that on violin. At the end of my second year, I had a big questioning period. where I wanted to stop playing because there was a ton of competition. The music industry is not easy. And certainly the life of university students, it's a lot. There's a lot of pressure there. And I did a little bit of traveling across Europe over the summer, and I came back and I told my teacher I was going to quit. That was it. And he was like, no, you can't. Like, you can't. Why don't you go take a lesson with another teacher? So I did, and it turned out that was my viola teacher. So I took a lesson with this viola teacher and sold my violin the next day. And it was a big moment for me of, I do love music. I was just done with the violin for a little while. And so I kind of progressed into that and went on, did my master's in viola. And then moving into Toronto after I was done, I started playing violin and viola again. Choosing to have a career in music is a choice, and yet it's not. It's you love it so much that it just has to be. That I couldn't picture myself doing anything else, especially when first moving here. I don't think that there was no other option for me. Music was part of who I am, and I had to do it, and that was just that. And for those who, you know, work that office job, I did that for a bit. You know, I moved to Toronto. I was like, I need to get a job. Yeah. And so I worked in an office for a little while and did the 9 to 5. And that was not for me. And so I think as I met my connections and built my own reputation in Toronto, I built my career. But it's not an easy one. You know, it's one that you have to continually have faith in. That the work is there, one that you can't give up on. It takes dedication, it takes hard work, it takes a lot of budgeting, and being really mindful of you know, what you want to do and what your goal is. I've been blessed. A big side of what I do as well is education, and I love passing on my love for strings to younger students. So a lot of, for me, my balance is performing and teaching, and I really love passing down that love to the younger ones. So that's been a nice balance of my career, and certainly financially, it's a great steady, I guess, employment that I have. But yeah, life as a musician, I mean, it's a fun one, but it's not easy.
So Liza, just as Maura is saying, it's not easy. Stress comes with it. Of course, not just the stress of being on stage. People think, oh, it's just a matter of, you know, anxiety on stage. There's a lot of other things that go into it, maintaining a budget or whatever you have to do, because not everybody is Geddy Lee or of that level of musician where it's just, I mean, you're a working musician, right? And right, there are working musicians, which is most musicians. I mean, certainly there's the elites, but not everybody's Taylor Swift or, you know, these megastars. So you're working, but it's more than just a job.
It can be the most wonderful thing. It helps you express yourself. It helps you help others. But it can be very cruel, too. And there you can, it's very easy to succumb to that nasty voice in your head that tells you, oh, you can't do this, or this is, you're going to be too nervous to do this, or you can't perform that, or you need to practice more, you need to do this. This person doesn't like your playing. That person doesn't like your playing. You're not good enough. Always these thoughts, you have to deal with it. And the industry, like many industries, you have to have a very thick skin and you have to take criticism. I mean, you're trained from childhood to take criticism from your teachers and from, so that is also part of your history as an artist. You, from the day you begin, you have a teacher. Or maybe you're just self-taught, but it all comes from you have to do better, you have to do more, you have to do better. And it's like what Moira was saying, I can't imagine not being a musician. It's the most honest thing I could do. I really feel that music will make and does make the world a better place, whether it's I'm making my own thing, which is just a drop in the bucket. I mean, most of what I do is collaborative and I work with other people and I love that. I love being part of I love being part of an orchestra, a big machine. It's wonderful. And then I love being one person on stage doing the performances. But, you know, like what we were saying, people watch these performances on stage and they think, well, it's just this one. Well, it's not. I mean, that's one moment from a million that's led you to that moment. And the amount of work, the hours of practice. I mean, if we got paid 5 cents for every hour of practice that we've done since we were five, you know, we'd be millionaires.
I have to say, though, that says so much about the underappreciation of what it means to be a musician. Because a lot of people think, and nothing against music these days, I'm a little older. So when I see all these music platforms where music is almost like a commodity, where not just, I mean, it's almost like if you have a computer or whatever, you can make some tracks or some beats. And mind you, that there's a place for that too. But it's not, I don't want to say the training isn't there, but it's not there. It's a lot easier to learn. You can go on YouTube and learn how to play a keyboard. There's also other ways to learn how to play instruments. I'm not minimizing the different ways. It's just that there's certain types of music, I think, that lend itself to, like you're saying, the hours and hours and hours of just being in it and living in it and working in it and striving for that perfection. I want to ask, though, Maura, of course, when you had the ability to work with all these great artists, and everything, Michael Bublé, The Who, you know, Barbra Streisand, you work with Peter Gabriel, one of my favorites. I saw Sarah McLachlan actually about a month ago. Love her. When you were growing up, you probably listened to these artists to some degree. Did you ever think you'd be playing with them? And also, how did you use music when you were younger, say, to get through tougher times? Because we know that people do that. So you're not only performing music, but how did you use music for yourself, see, as a coping tool or to just get through those tougher days?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I had put down there Sarah McLachlan as one of my songs, and I'm great that you went to see her. I never thought in a million years that I would have the chance to play with some of these amazing artists. I mean, it's just been, we've been lucky, and Toronto is a great place to be for being able to do these shows with these fantastic artists. But for me growing up, I mean, I had a tough high school years. I mean, I actually lost one of my friends to suicide when I was in grade 10. And then 2 months later, my grandfather died. And it was a really, really tough couple of years for me in high school. So mental health-wise, music was definitely there. And I think playing music more than listening to it, actually. So, you know, Sarah McLachlan's Angel Song, definitely. I mean, that was, I think, if you look at the meaning behind the song, it's about dying of overdose, and you know, so I think listening to that and going through the tough times, and then just for me, it was playing was my outlet. So closing myself in a practice room and kind of playing some of these songs, or you know, just practicing and getting my mind away. I dabbled in a little of composition when I was in high school, but then haven't really done it since. But just, yeah, being able to play my instrument and kind of have my own space and my own, you know, mind, I guess, to deal with what I was going through. But yeah, it's incredible. Mental health as a musician is huge. And like Eliza said, you know, going on to stage is not just about the anxiety, but the telling yourself, like, I can do this, or, you know, not letting that negative voice creep in, or when it does creep in, you know, learning how to deal with it. And so, you know, it's funny, like, I when I go and play music, for me, it's a lot of, like, going back to my roots, or going back to even things like longbows and scales, because it's just, you can control, and learning to control it, and then using that to, as an out, like, as a mental out. So, but yeah, music is definitely, it's always there, like Isa said, morning and night.
You just said something that made me think. So as a musician and you're playing, you are in control, more or less, right? You're controlling the bow, you're controlling your fingers, you're controlling the tone, you're in control. And of course, from my perspective, having worked in behavioral health, a lot of people, when they feel out of control, is when they feel off balance or out of sorts. So I'm taking it then you're saying that having the ability to have that control to play as you want or to make that sound that you want reinforced and helped you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us about the Angel Song a little bit more.
Well, okay. So like I said, I had a really good friend who committed suicide, and I think that song came out with like, or it was right out when that happened. And so I used to put it on repeat over and over. I used to fall asleep to the song, kind of thinking of my friend and thinking of, you know, overdose and the angels up there and looking down. And I don't have a ton to say other than that I think the meaning of the song was really true to what I was going through. And I think it's a good song for anyone out there who's also going through similar things.
Welcome back to Mindful Music. I'm Carl Schallhorn with Liza McClellan and Moira Burke from Deva Quartet, the Toronto-based prog rock ensemble. We just heard Sarah McLachlan from her second album, Surfacing. So I know we've talked about where you've been and where you've come from. And as I mentioned in the opening, you're just kind of hitting your stride as a group with these releases, Prometheus. What's coming up next? What do you see for the future? Are we going to see another release, going back in the studio, touring?
Yeah, we're working on a new couple of new albums, a couple of new concept albums. We go back into studio in September to record a one-off song by Joy Division.
Oh, please tell me, what is that going to be?
I'm not supposed to.
So that's a teaser.
It's a teaser.
Oh, man.
But we will be releasing some information about that soon.
I will definitely check that one out.
Yes. Are you a Joy Division fan?
I like old school alternative, so right up my alley.
Well, we'll do our best.
And so that, but what about live performing?
It's tricky these days. Mostly now we can, you know, it's not about COVID and lockdowns and things. But with the grand reopening of the world, our careers have like suddenly, it's kind of crazy. We went from full stop to like just full gear, like straight down the highway. And we all have families. Mm. So right now we're in the thick of balancing just getting our rehearsing schedules back to get playing together with like a crazy amount of work that's suddenly fallen into our laps, each of us personally, professionally. So it's been an incredible time, I think, actually, in the music industry. People are seeking out live music again like never before in many ways, because you just can't take it for granted anymore. You know, tomorrow we may be told you can't go out again. So people are going out again, and so there's been so many concerts, and we've all been so incredibly busy. So I feel like now that we've had this time and we're all kind of, we're resorting ourselves, and we have these projects coming up, which is great, because I think every group needs that or you'll just stop being a group,
right?
You know? So yeah, the future is bright, and we're just kind of, now that we're all playing together again and getting things going, we've got these recording projects coming up. We'll start booking some more shows. We do have a show. Actually, I should say we have a show coming up in Collingwood July 10th. And that's kind of neat. It actually touches on sort of our growth as artists from the typical string quartet, where we're going to be playing like Haydn string quartet, and then we're going to do Shostakovich. And then we're going to do some James Brown, and then we're going to do some fiddling style stuff. We're going to do some 2112. We're going to do some of my original stuff on the electrics. So this show coming up will be, it's like the morphology of our quartet from standard acoustic instrumentation to full-on band with drummer. Yeah, should be fun.
Now, I have to say, before we go, you've made reference to families. Tell us about the families, because we can't forget about the families who support you through all these endeavors.
Oh, gosh, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my my family. I couldn't be doing what I do. I rely so heavily. I have one daughter, but and she brings me such joy, you know. I'm so lucky. She's 8. Yes. And my husband's very supportive of myself, but also all artists. He himself isn't a working musician, but he's a very fine guitar player. And he knows and respects the amount of work that goes into doing what we do. So I'm so lucky to have him. And then, of course, my own parents and his mom and our extended family have all been able to help when I need to go play a show, when I need to go on tour, when I need to go into studio, when I'm doing these shows. Like, it's, I'm so lucky.
What about you, Mari?
Yeah, I definitely have, I have a busy plate. I've got 3 kids. So so my oldest is about to be 16, and I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old. So it's a busy life. And I think, yeah, that it you need that support behind you. It was funny during COVID, when I wasn't playing, my 16-year-old came up one day and he was like, why aren't you like performing? And I was like, well, we're living through a pandemic. And he was like, yeah, but things are starting to open up. Like, you know, you should like go back and perform. And I'm like, yeah, but thank you. Like, thank you for recognizing that this is what I need. So I think, you know, growing up, he's been kind of part of my career with Deva. We actually started when he was just a newborn. And so he's been there through it all. He's been lugged to rehearsals. He's been, you know, I've brought my kids traveling with me. And it really does take a village to be a musician and have a family is indeed very hard. And I think especially it's worth saying that, you know, the music industry is not always the most supportive of female freelancers, you know, because it's not easy to have children and be a freelance musician. And not everyone is as open to, you know, having children in the dressing room and things like that. So I've been really lucky, and I do have a fantastic supportive spouse who understands the music world. He dabbles in the DJing world, and so he understands the gigging and the gone at night and that kind of thing. So he's been an awesome support. And yeah, my family, my mom and dad and his parents are my incredible babysitters.
So I want to actually get back to the point what you're talking about, Maura, where you are referencing being a woman in the music industry, which as some, if many people know, I know, is not easy, whether you be a big name or someone who is, like I said, working or freelance or whatever. What have been the challenges of being a working woman musician in the industry and facing what has oftentimes been seen as, I don't call it paternalistic or male dominated. What's that like to be a woman in the industry? We'll do both of you.
I mean, I can give you an example of, you know, something that's happened to so many performing musicians in Toronto. And that is that of, you know, for women who have children and who, let's say, are breastfeeding them, when we're asked to do concerts, you know, we are asked to, you know, come and perform, but often we have to bring our children with us. In orchestras, like unionized orchestras, often they have a very, like a set time for your breaks. So, you know, you have 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And often what happens is in rehearsal, they'll say, you know what, guys, is everybody okay with taking 15 now and then 10 off the end? And so I remember sitting in an orchestra once and that kind of got said, and I was like, no, actually, like, I'm not okay with that because I need to go in my 20 minutes or 25 minutes that I have and feed my baby. That was like, well, then you're going to be considered late. And so it was a very strict, like, no, you cannot go. And you're here because you've been hired and everybody else said yes. So it was a matter of, you know, getting, you know, we have union reps within the orchestras and stuff like that, but it's not easy. And then you have wonderful producers who are really open to it. I once did, actually, with my youngest child, I got asked to do a recording of a TV show. And I was about not even 2 weeks postpartum. And it was with, it was an awesome TV show, but Bryan Adams was there. And I was like, oh, this is oh, I really want to do this one. I should say no. And the producer was like, you know what? I've got you. We're going to give you a room. Bring your spouse. You're going to have a private room for him. You're going to get catering to the room. Just, you know, you'll be on and off stage. We want you. And so it was a matter of him just being like, yeah, she's a mom, but I want her. We're going to accommodate what she needs and make it work. And so you do have amazing, you know, producers and people that are out there that will be understanding, but a lot of it is not. It's very male dominated. And if you look at the contractors even around Toronto, there are very few female contractors. You know, Sharon actually contracts, she is one of them. She contracts an orchestra in town, but most of the other orchestras are all males. And it, there's an understanding that just they don't understand. So, yeah. What about you, Liza?
Just to touch on some of the, it's more the obvious things, like how you look. And it's a tricky, because as a female, you know, we've spent a lot, as any male does, we've had the same amount of time practicing. You've been playing, in my case, I started cello when I was 4 years old. Same as any male cellist, same amount of time. But in a lot of cases, you will find that you're being hired not so much on how well you're playing, but how what you look like, which is another thing. And I get that that is part of the entertainment industry. Like, I get that. But I do feel that there's a different set of restrictions on women that don't necessarily exist for men. That being said, right now, there's such a turning, like people are kind of more aware of it more than ever. And now there's kind of a turning away in that men aren't even getting hired for things. They just want all women, which is another issue. You know, it's not, again, it's not based on who's the best for the job. It's more about who looks like the best for the job, which is right. Which is interesting. I feel like it's growing pains of the industry a little bit. But yeah, it's a different set of challenges, which can be frustrating, or they can work in your favor or against you, depending. And the frustrating side there is like, well, there's nothing to do with how you play, you know? Unfortunately, you know, for me, I've always want it to be fair, you know? And it isn't, but what industry is?
Yeah, and like I said, I think we're seeing a sea change in terms of just the world, in a sense, with women empowerment. But as the old saying goes, we've got a long way to go.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, I'm old enough to remember the movement of the 70s and, you know, women's power and, you know, Gloria Steinem. And we've made progress, but there's still a way to go. And of course, but now we have the adult elements of social media and youth. And so now we have, it's complicated, as they say. So, well, listen, I wanted to say a huge thank you. This is amazing. So thank you, Liza and Maura, for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.